to you across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Kerry Deese of Preferred Financial Services. Join us for the next hour. We're going to take a look at your home in a different light. We're going to look at your home as a financial investment, what it can mean to you, your financial future, and your family's future. So grab a cup of coffee and join us as we discuss a little bit of a different topic for mortgage people today. Kerry, Americans have a lot of choices when it comes to housing, and always the biggest choice is whether you rent or you choose to buy a home.
Sure.
And if the choice is to own a home, I think we've got to answer some questions about how we go about maximizing the investment that we're going to make in our home. I think if we're going to be honest in looking at things, we need to ask the question, is a home a good investment? We hear that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I first looked at getting into business years and years ago, I didn't really have a clue how big the mortgage market was. But the statistics said that something like 63 or 4% of all Americans owned a home. That seemed like a pretty big market to me. I remember going down to the county courthouse. This is in like 1989. And I walked into the registrar's office and I said, okay, how many mortgages are there here in Greenville County? And they pointed to a shelf because they weren't even on microfilm back then, much less digital. And there was literally a shelf that ran about 40 feet. It was only about 3 feet high, but it had three volumes, you know, stacked, three shelves. And those were full of recorded mortgages. So I still didn't have a clue. So I asked the registrar, you know, how many are there out there? And they said, well, that's about 125,000 mortgages. So, wow, that caught my attention. I would have thought a third that much. I just had no idea how large the market was. But what it began to clue me in as I was looking at the mortgage business itself is how many Americans owned a house. The other exciting thing to me as a businessman was if there were 36% of the population that didn't own a house, you could almost say that everybody among them wanted to own a house. So I think home ownership has always been a big driving factor in the sense of how Americans view themselves, how they view their freedom, their liberty, the right to own property, and all of those things. But I think we've got to ask a question, is a house a good investment? Because I've seen some financial letters floating around that suggest that, well, maybe sometimes you're better off renting, and there may be some times, but we want to look at that. And then we want to look at both the short-term and the long-term benefits of going either way. So I thought we'd start by taking the average person in our listening area. Average means, you know, you go to the Google, you click on what's the average income in upstate South Carolina. And Kerry, I thought I had a figure here. What's the average household income in our listening area?
It's about $50,000 per year.
Okay. About $50,000 a year. So if we take that figure as mortgage people, how much of a mortgage house payment could the average person in our listening area afford?
About $1,250 a month.
Okay. So about a third of what they earn in gross earnings, as we've talked about on previous shows, they can let that go towards house payments. So when we are going to look at renting versus buying, we're going to try to put everything on an apples-to-apples basis and say, okay, the average family has $1,250 a month that can be committed to housing. Is that money better off going to the landlord for rent, or is it better off going to the lender to pay a 30-year mortgage? What in the end is the best thing to do? Now, I also want to translate that $1,250 payment to some dollar figures for a house. So whenever you go to buy a house, affordability is what we call debt-to-income ratios. So that $1,250 payment is what the average person in this listing area can afford if they want to buy that much house. And Kerry, what would that translate to about dollar-wise in the amount of house they could buy?
Now, included in that payment would be the taxes, insurance, and monthly mortgage insurance. So that would support about a $200,000 purchase price.
That's right. And again, that can vary individual to individual. Some people are going to pay a higher rate because they have lower credit scores. Some people's PMI is going to be higher. Some people can go with no monthly PMI. But we're talking about the average family in our listening area with the average income is going to be able to purchase a home in the $200,000 range and end up with a payment in the $1,250 range when it's all said and done. So we're going to compare if we took $1,250 a month and paid rent, What do we get for that? What expenses do we avoid with that? Because, you know, when you're renting, hot water heater breaks down, your landlord fixes it. You don't
right.
fix it. And so there are some expenses that you avoid by renting, but also some benefits you may be missing by not owning a house. So we're going to talk about, we're going to compare them apples to apples. First of all, Carrie, I think this one blew me away when I did the math. And I also want to get apples to apples. Let's look at a 30-year scenario. Because
okay.
most people, when they buy a house, they're going to use a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. So let's look at what happens to the average family over that 30-year period, whether they rent or whether they buy. First of all, the one that blew me away, if you rent for 30 years at $1,250 a month, how much have you paid out in 30 years in rent?
$450,000.
God, that is that caught me off guard. You know,
that's insane.
I mean, we live with numbers. I do numbers all day long, but that one just blew me away. About $500,000
mm-hmm.
that you have paid out in rent. And what do you have at the end of that?
Other than the security that your repairs will be taken care of,
right.
not much of anything.
Yeah, that's the other shocking thing is you basically put $500,000 towards something that you really don't have anything at the end. There is no asset there. There's nothing to own. You may have avoided some other expenses, and to be honest, in everything, we're going to look at those. But wow, that's staggering.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, you might check the box that home ownership is far and away better than renting. But let's look at some other factors involved in this. Now, one thing we didn't assume, and we're going to get into this too, is that that rent that you started out paying $1,250 a month for is not going to stay at $1,250 for the life of the loan.
No, that probably won't even stay at $1,250 for a single year.
No, that's right. So I wanted to be conservative with this figure. Inflation is generally, and I looked this up statistically, it's averaged over the last 60 years, 3.2% a year. So let's just use a 3% inflation figure. But let's be really generous on the rent side and say that rent inflation is only half of regular inflation. Let's plug in a figure of 1.5% increase in your rent every year. Carrie, if we plug that in over that 30-year period, assuming your rent would go up 1.5% a year, how much have you paid out in 30 years then?
Believe it or not, $528,120.
Gosh, oh, Mosey.
Whew.
So now we've gone past the 450 mark to $528,000, and that's conservative. Rent usually keeps pace with inflation.
Mm-hmm.
But even being conservative with it, $528,000 paid out over 30 years to get to the end and not have anything to show for it. And your rent at that time, 30 years from now, would be about $1,685 a month if it had just increased 1.5%. So let's take purchasing a home with a 30-year loan, $1,250 in payments. At the end of 30 years, you've paid out $450,000, just like if you paid rent for $1,250 a month for 30 years. So with a home, you have done that. But what happens at the end of that, Carrie, at the end of purchasing, at the end of making your home mortgage payment, what do you have?
You have a $200,000 asset.
That's right. And then that little inflation thing that ran the cost of rent up, that inflation has also been raising the value of your asset. If you assume that 3% inflation, that home that was worth $200,000 today will be worth about $500,000 30 years from now. Now, that's not real increase in value, but that is keeping pace with inflation
sure.
over time. When we get back, we're going to look at how to accelerate a home as investment. Join us.
Thank you for joining us this morning. We're talking about your home as an investment. Now, as Mark and I continue to do these shows, we're realizing that we are running out of material. So if you have any suggestions We absolutely welcome them. Give us a call Monday through Friday, 864-235-9596. You can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And, of course, if you want to listen to one of our past shows, just check out our website at preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
And I encourage all you parents out there, if your kids are asleep, as all teenagers are, and they may not listen to this stuff when they're teenagers, but pass this particular one on to your children. They've got the longest window to make these investments work, and it's great information for kids that are starting out with their first home to have, just to compare what they should do when they get out of college, when they finish school, when they get their first job. Do you want to rent for 30 years, or do you want to own a home? Now, we were looking at it before the break, saying that the average person in our area paying $1,250 a month in rent with a little bit of inflation is going to end up paying out about $528,000 over the next 30 years to get to the end of that and not have anything effectively to show for it. They've lived in a home, they've had shelter, but there is no asset there when they finish. On the other hand, a family that started out making a $1,250 a month house payment after 30 years has a paid-off house that they bought for $200,000, but inflation has raised to around $500,000. One of the missing pieces here, though, that we've got to look at is that house that was bought 30 years ago has had to have ongoing maintenance over that 30-year period. And by maintenance, we mean heating and air systems give out, hot water heaters blow up, your appliances go bad, flooring eventually wears out. So there's a lot of ongoing maintenance with a house. Does that offset the benefits? Well, let's look at that. I had to get some figures, and again, you can Google all these things. You know, we act like we're experts. Sometimes we're just good Googlers. And to find out, okay, what's the recommended amount to cover ongoing maintenance on a house? And rule of thumb came up over and over again that you ought to expect about 1% of the value of the house to be needed annually for maintenance. So, hey, we've been talking about a $200,000 house here. So we're talking about $2,000 a year in average maintenance costs. Now, again, we have to adjust that for inflation over the next 30 years. So in doing that, I came up with the figure that if you bought a $200,000 house today, you could expect over the next 30 years to have spent around $90,000 in maintenance costs. That's inflation adjusted over that time. So, yes, you've got a $500,000 asset at the end of paying off that home, but you've also spent about $90,000 to keep that home in decent shape. Are we still ahead of it? Well, you take the $500,000, you subtract the $90,000 that you spend in maintenance, and you've still got $410,000 in net asset value that you would not have if you were renting. So basically, a renter after 30 years has put out about $528,000 in investment money, and they have accumulated zero value. A homeowner has put out about $540,000. That's house payment plus maintenance. But now they own a $500,000 asset. I think if there's one great driver to the answer that, yes, owning a home is far greater investment than renting, it would have to be that. Now, Carrie, let's turn our thoughts here because at some point, 30 years away from somewhere, and sometime, people want to retire. If you're 35 years old, that puts you right at 65 to retire. That's why I say if you start these principles early, when you first get out of school, when you first get your first job, you're going to be way ahead of the curve here. We got a lot of borrowers out there that are in their 30s, going into their 40s, and may not have bought a house yet, or may have bought a house but maybe kept refinancing it, still have 30 years left on it. But at some point, you got to think about retirement. What's going to happen, Carrie, to our renter 30 years down the road when they're ready to retire? What are they going to be doing with their housing? How are they going to pay for it and what's going to cost them?
They're still going to have a $1,685 rent payment as they go into retirement.
That's right. Inflation adjusted, and again, being very conservative, 30 years down the road, they have not accumulated an asset. And 30 years down the road, they still have to provide housing. And that's going to cost, according to the adjusted inflation numbers, about $1,685. Well, the homeowner is going to have a house paid off, but that doesn't quite mean that there's no housing expense, because there's still those pesky taxes and insurance to be paid. So I took on the $200,000 home that we bought 30 years ago, and I adjusted for inflation about what they would expect to need to continue to pay for maintenance items every month, and about what they would be paying in taxes and insurance each month. And I put those figures together. They would need about $500 a month for continued maintenance on the house, because the house still is going to have heating and air systems going out and appliances needing to be fixed. Taxes adjusted for inflation and the fact that at retirement you get a little bit of break on taxes, they're up to about $180 per month by now. And insurance is probably in the $150 a month range. When you add all of those together, the person who has spent 30 years making a house payment, although they don't owe any more to the lender, they now are going to need about $830 a month to cover their housing expense. But look, that's less than half of what the renter is going to pay.
Right.
So going into retirement, not only is a house an asset that is preserved and is still there, but it's actually half as cheap, half as much expense to own a house as it is to still be renting at that point. Now, the other choice is that you may get to retirement and say, well, I don't want to keep up with all this maintenance anymore. I'm tired of cutting the grass and raking the leaves. Of course, you can buy a townhouse and cover it that way. But, you know, you've got a $500,000 asset. You can sell the house if you want to at that point. You can start renting then if you want. In fact, if you pocketed the $500,000 that you got from the sale of your house, you could pay your rent for 25 more years.
Wow.
Yeah, just from the proceeds of your home. So at least having the home paid off gives you some options at the point of retirement in which you can dramatically reduce your housing expense, liquidate the asset, and use those funds to pay your rent for another 25 years. So you've got all kinds of options if you have purchased a home. And here's another thing that I want all of our listeners to begin to think about, and that is a home as an asset is something that you have the capacity to pass on to your children that at the right time in their life may supplement their retirement, may give them capital to do the things that they have never been able to do, start their own business, get into their own business. It gives the possibility of providing seed capital for the things that your children may want to do. You know, generally in the generational cycles, at about the time we are statistically ready to die, our children are approaching retirement age. How wonderful would it be then to leave them that $500,000 house divided two ways, three ways? That's a substantial leg up going into retirement for them. And hey, what if your children had practiced the same thing for 30 years that you practiced for 30 years? So when they get to retirement, their house is paid off and you've just handed them a large capital sum. Well, they're going to be able to turn around and do the same thing to their children. Now, that's your grandchildren, but your grandchildren, instead of receiving a $500,000 liquidated asset in an estate, is going to have $1 million. I want to tell you, and I don't know if our listeners can realize this, but this is how families build wealth. This is how this really is, I think, of most wealthy individuals, how they got where they got to. And that is, only a very few strike out on an idea and say, I'm going to build this company, I'm going to have this idea, I'm going to make $1 million. Most of those who we term wealthy are wealthy because their families have, for generations, passed down capital to generation after generation. And if that second generation invests that capital, then they have a higher return. They pass on more capital to their children. And this is where generational wealth can lift families and communities out of poverty. It can set up families and generations for success. And you know what? Maybe you didn't get handed this by your parents. Maybe they either could not or simply did not make plans in this way. But you know what? You can be the one who breaks that generational poverty in your own family. If you own a house, simply by making a payment to a lender instead of making a payment to a landlord, simply by living within the means and paying off a house, you've got something to pass along that you can do something to affect generations to come, basically to bless the generations that are coming behind you. And if they will follow the same road and the same path, then you can have family that develops wealth and has resources to do all of the things that, we desire to do and to leverage those assets out for the future generations. This can break families and communities out of generational poverty. And so owning a home can be a far greater act than just taking care of yourself. It can be something that you bless your children with and even your grandchildren with. Now, we want to talk about, if you're going to own a home, how can we take the simple concepts that we've just talked about, how can we make them better? How do we maximize your home as an investment? I want to tell you a story about a couple that came in to my office about 15 years ago. They were both public school teachers in Pickens County. And at the time, their salaries were about $24,000, $25,000 each. So they would, in their time, have had about a median income, kind of like the people that we're talking about right now. And Carrie, when they came in, they brought their asset statements because they were selling their house and they were buying a new house. And they sat down an asset statement with a local stockbroker, and their account had $650,000 in it.
Wow.
And, you know, I don't ever mean to intrude on anybody's privacy, but I said, you know, I just got to ask you a question. How was it that you came about to have this much money? They were in their 40s. When we get back off the break, I'm going to tell you how this couple, with no outside help, they did not win the lottery because I asked them that. They didn't gamble, hadn't been to Vegas. How did they accumulate over $600,000 within the first 20 years of their marriage? We'll talk about it after the break. Talk about maximizing your home investment. Thanks for joining us. As we finish up the second half of the program today, we're talking about your home as an investment. And let me encourage any of you out there, at whatever stage you are, early in your life and planning and family or later on, feel free to call me. I am more than happy to have a sit-down, face-to-face conversation with you or even a phone conversation. Take your situation where you are and answer the questions. How do we make it great from here? How do we make it better? How do we make it the best it can be? How can I use my home to leverage myself? How can I leverage that to my children and my grandchildren? How can I help my family out of generational poverty? Or how can I set it up where my grandchildren will be able to choose to run their own businesses because they've got the seed capital to do it? We can look at both short and long-term plans. And the long-term plans, I think, are the motivations that keep us going. If we can understand that the reasons we're doing certain things now are for the future value of things, we can put our shoulders to the load and get it done. So feel free to reach out to me. I'll be happy to meet with you to kind of set in motion your financial planning with the house as the centerpiece. It's a great starting point. Now, before the break, I was talking about this couple from Pickens who came in to see me about 15 years ago, ready to buy their second home. And when they sat down with me, they handed me an asset statement that had over $600,000 in it. And they were living off two teachers' salaries. And I asked the question, how were you able to do this? And you know what their answer was, Carrie?
I think I might have an inkling.
Since I'm giving you hand signals and stuff. All right. So how had they done that?
They chose to live on just one of their salaries.
That was amazing to me.
It's really smart.
I said, you got to be kidding me. They said, no, we got out of college. We got married. We both went to work as teachers. They've been working, you know, at the same school for the 20 years at that point. And they said, we just chose to live off one salary. I said, that's amazing to me. I mean, you know, that resulted in $640,000 in money in the bank.
That's just staggering.
It is staggering. It shows you the compounding effect of money, which is great. Money invested compounds. But what it also told me is, and it was a real eye-opener to me, and that is that every day has financial choices. And those financial choices, if they're the right ones, they multiply. They get huge after a while. Because in the laws of doubling, if this same couple 15 years ago has been able to average 5 to 6% on their portfolio, their portfolio is now worth in excess of $1.5 million all day long, pushing $2 million today as they near retirement. And that's an astounding thing. So, the point I want to make here is that this couple made a choice. Now, I will be honest with you, probably not many of us would make that choice, okay? That may be a little bit extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about an easier choice. Let's say the same couple we've been talking about this whole time, the couple making $50,000 a year between them, the average income in our area, let's say they bought the average house, the $200,000 house, and they've got the average payment, which is a $1,250 a month payment. What would happen, Carrie, if they just added $100 to their payment? Not live on half the income, not double the house payment. I'm talking, instead of making a $1,250 payment, what if they made a $1,350 payment? What would happen to that same 30-year loan?
It would cut off 5 years, and they could pay off the loan in 25 years instead of 30.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just $100 and you eliminate 5 years of payments. Now, guess how much that would save them in interest? Carrie, we got that figure here somewhere. How much just by that $100, how much do they save in interest?
$34,000. That's more than one of their salaries.
That's unbelievable. I mean, I think, you hear these sayings and they're always attributed to somebody. I heard that Rockefeller said that the compounding of interest is the eighth wonder of the world. Well, this is kind of like that. This is the reverse compounding of interest. This is, instead of paying the interest for 30 years, you just pay it for 25. All of a sudden, you're saving $34,000 in interest charges over that same period. And let's think about this, Carrie. What if at the end of 25 years, your house is now paid off, okay? But instead of stopping there, what if you take the same 30-year period we started with everybody, and for the last 5 years, you make a house payment to yourself? Why not? Okay, and I'm talking about still, okay, you got to pay your taxes and your insurance and your maintenance. We're still doing that. But just take what you were paying the lender and now pay yourself for 5 years. How much money you got in a bank after 5 years?
$81,000.
My gosh. So not only have you saved $34,000, this is $100, folks. Anybody can do this. If you have a mortgage today, you can do this today. You don't have to buy a new house to start out with this. You start with this today. Save yourself $34,000 in interest, plus bank $81,000 at the end of this 30-year program. That is just an astounding thing to me. And you still own the $500,000 asset.
Right.
At the end of all this. And you go into retirement with no house payment. You just have your taxes and insurance to pay. That numbers, when I have 30 years in this business, when I apply interest numbers over time, I am always astounded by it. Because here's what happens. In a normal 30-year loan for this $200,000 house, you are paying a boatload of interest, $137,000 in interest over that period of time. And just by an extra $100, you've cut that down substantially. Now, that $100 is a very little amount to compound to an awful lot of money. But whenever you put a challenge out like this, somebody's going to say, well, I can do better than that. I can do more than $100. So let's talk about somebody who really wants to put this plan on steroids. When you go out to buy a home, most people will choose a 30-year mortgage. Because the payment's the lowest. But what if instead of choosing a 30-year mortgage, you said, well, what if I want to spend the same exact amount on a house, the $1,250, but I want to buy a house that I can pay off in 15 years? That's one way of leveraging money. So instead of buying a $200,000 house to have that $1,250 30-year payment, you would have to buy a $155,000 house and put it on a 15-year loan. Well, that's a choice you can make. What does that do for us? Okay, let's look at the numbers. Now your house is paid off in 15 years. It was a less expensive house to begin with. So in 30 years, that house is worth $387,000 instead of $500,000, because we were with the other scenario starting with a $200,000 house. Now we're starting with a cheaper house. So it's worth $387,500. But hey, Carrie, what if after 15 years you started making your house payment to yourself? Just like we were going to do with $100 for the last 5 years, but now you can make a house payment to yourself for 15 years. How much money do you have in the bank at the end of 30 years?
Instead of that $81,000 we had, we're going to have $251,000 in the bank.
A quarter of $1 million in the bank. Just because you chose less house than you could have lived in, you decided to pay it off in 15 years instead of 30, and you began making your house payment to yourself, you just added a quarter of $1 million.
And don't forget the home that you still have that's paid off.
You still got the asset.
$387,000.
It's astounding. So anyone who wants to really take on a challenge, if you want to convert what you've got right now to finish off paying it in 15 years, call me up. We can give you an amortization chart to do that. You don't have to refinance to do it. You can take your current, 28 years remaining on your mortgage, and you say to me, Mark, I want this thing paid off in 15 years. I want you to show me where I'll be when I do that. We'll run all those numbers for you. It's really amazing. When you uncoil the snake that is compounding interest, and you turn that thing and make it work to your benefit, it's equally as astounding what you can do for yourself as what you were doing for the lender who was making all that money off of you while you were paying that mortgage back over that term. So the person who wants to live in a little bit less house, pay it off in 15 years, and make 15 years worth of house payment to themselves, they've got $251,000 in cash plus their house at $387,500. That means this person has $638,500 to pass along to their children, and in addition, along the way, you only paid about $57,000 interest on this home instead of $137,000 interest. What a great investment. Now, Carrie, we have some people who want to do the $100 plan, but also will ask us, because this gets advertised from time to time, what about a biweekly payment plan? Some people get paid twice a month. I guess what do you call that, bi-monthly?
Semi-monthly.
Semi-monthly, okay. Or you get paid every 2 weeks, which is bi-weekly. Some people want to couple their pay with their mortgage payment and make half a mortgage payment every 2 weeks. So we're going to talk about what effect that will have on your 30-year loan when we get back, how that, too, can have substantial savings for you, and how you can set that up with your lender if you want to go that route. Join us after the break down the home stretch. This is The Mortgage Moment with Carrie Deese and Mark Wells.
Coming down the final stretch here on the great investment of buying a home. You know, I think this has been one of the most interesting shows that we've done, looking at all of the numbers. You know, you really don't think about things in that way.
No, I live around them, and then just putting them together for this show, just again, it just astounded me.
Yeah. So as always, if you have questions, give us a call, 864-235-9596. We are always here for you, whatever types of questions you have.
And look, we'll help you put your own plan together.
Sure.
It doesn't matter where you are. It really does not. I want to emphasize that. Doesn't matter what age you are. Doesn't matter where you're starting from. What we generally lack is just a cohesive plan to get down the road where we want to be. And if we can get that goal in mind. That's what keeps our focus. It's what allows us to make the sacrifices, to do the things that we do, to get where we want to be. I've always said that when you look at the concentration camps that were instituted by the most repressive governments ever on the face of the earth, it was never hard work that broke the will of those who were in the concentration camps. It was always the deliberate lack of purpose in the work that broke people psychologically. In other words, here's a pile of rocks. I want you to move it over here. And so that's work. You're moving it from here to there. But then, okay, now I need you to move it right back over where it was. There's no meaning there. That's where we psychologically collapse. And when people don't have a purpose for the things they do, you can't sustain it. You really cannot. So we can help you get an end goal here. Have a plan for you and your family. Even if you weren't gifted great management skills by your parents in terms of finances, you can stop that. It's a decision. Just as this couple decided to live on half of a salary or live on one salary instead of two, you can make choices too. You're never too far gone and you're never too far away, so we're happy to be a part.
And like we've talked about in previous shows, you know, there is nothing that you can't recover from. And I know
for
me personally, no matter what the obstacle is, if I can figure out a plan of how I'm going to handle things, it doesn't seem so
overwhelming.
Overwhelming.
Right. Exactly. You can do that. And you know, in light of that, as we were talking through the break, we have encountered so many people who have moved into this country who have just put these kind, simple things into practice that within a generation are passing on capital and wealth to their children. It's amazing to watch. They are more American than we are because they believe in the concepts. When they come here, that's what they've been looking for, the opportunity to get ahead. And so they do it.
Mm-hmm.
They make the family choices. They make the financial choices, the first generation especially, so that the next generation that comes will have a leg up and be ahead above and beyond anyone else. It's remarkable to see, and all of us can do it. We were talking about before the break about a biweekly payment. If your salary or pay comes in every 2 weeks, what ends up is that you have 26 pay periods. So there's a mortgage program you can enter into. The servicing arm of your lender will let you do it. I do not recommend you use an outside service to do it, but your lender will set up a biweekly payment. And Carrie, in a biweekly payment, how is the lender, what are they doing with the monthly payment, the house payment?
All they do is take your payment, cut it in half, and you pay it every 2 weeks instead of every month.
So you pay a half payment every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And what results in that, because there are then 26 half payments, that's 13 whole payments. And effectively along the way in a biweekly payment system, you're making an extra house payment every year. Now, what is the effect of that? Well, it's almost identical to the scenario in which we added $100 a month to the house payment. It has the effect of decreasing the life of the loan from 30 years down to 25 years. And just as the extra $100 resulted in $34,000 less interest paid, ended in 5 years paying off your house early, where you can then make your house payment to yourself and accumulate $81,000 over the last 5 year stretch. Instead of having a house payment you're paying to the lender, you pay it to yourself. All of this same thing can be accomplished with a biweekly payment. It just may seem a little less painful to you because the payment going out is associated with your paycheck as it comes in every 2 weeks. Now, there's usually a setup charge for biweekly payments. And Carrie, I think, how much do they usually charge for that?
You know, $250?
Yeah, it runs between $250 and $350. So I would only use the biweekly payment if it's convenient and you're paid every 2 weeks. If you're paid monthly or you're paid weekly, you may just want to add the $100 yourself to your payment and pay it monthly yourself. It all accomplishes the same thing. It decreases the interest. It pays your loan off early. And one thing I do not suggest for a biweekly payment is do not use an outside source, because what they will do is accumulate your half, your extra amount, and only apply it once a year. And you're not getting as big an effect. That actually pays your loan off in 27 and a half years instead of 25 years. So if you're going to go with a biweekly payment, use the one that your lender's servicing arm is executing for you. So they apply that extra as you go. It has a lot more impact. We want to finish up today in our financial planning around a house. We mentioned in the very first section of our program today that there are maintenance costs associated with a house. Now, Carrie, weekly, I have someone call me up and they say, my heating and air system went out and I need a home equity line because I got to replace it. Or they say, my roof's 20 years old and I need a home equity line because I'll replace the roof. That's always a little bit discouraging to me, because it means that there hasn't been some ongoing planning for expenses that you know are going to come at some point. So I want to talk about another good financial plan, and that is, rather than waiting for the expenses to hit you and trying to scramble to find the money, because you're probably going to end up borrowing it and you're going to pay more interest on top of more interest, why not, from the get-go, with the house that you buy or from where you are right now, if you own a house right now, today, what you need to do is set up a house account. Now, for me, Carrie, and I do this myself, my house account is simply a separate little savings account that I have labeled at my bank house maintenance account. And what I do every month is, as I write out my house payment, I write out a check, or in this case, I just transfer the money from my regular checking account over into that little savings account, and that is for my maintenance items. And that way, when the maintenance comes, and I don't know about you guys, but I think there's something about the fabric of the universe, because I've always found that if my washing machine goes out, it commits suicide. I think before it goes, it sends a note over to my dishwasher and says, I'm checking out of this place. And why don't you join me? We'll be a whole lot better off in the appliance graveyard.
And then everything comes in threes.
And then
oven
it's not
behind.
Enough. That's right. It is not enough for the dishwasher and the washing machine to go in cahoots, but doggone, they drag the microwave in or the oven or something. So you find yourself not with one thing, but four or five. So here's what I do. I budget it monthly. I put it in the account because the day is going to come when I need that money. Let's talk about how much. I'm going to give you some dollar figures because I've just finished renovating a house. This was a rental house that I owned, and I got some really fresh figures on some things. So the rental house I'm renovating is, you know, in the $175,000 range. I just put new roof, new siding, new windows, new appliances, new kitchen, new floors, new. This is a new house when I finish with it, and I got all the numbers right here. If your heating and air system goes out on you and you got to replace the heat pump on the outside and the air handler inside, you're going to be looking at about $8,000 to
$9,000. Yikes.
That hurts. Roof. I mean, this is bad. I was a builder in the 80s, and so all of my numbers are ancient. And when I expect something to be one thing, I am shocked. Roof's probably around 10 grand. For a roof on a relatively small house. And that's just depending on if your pitch isn't like a 12-on-12 pitch where they got to hang off the roof to roof it. That can be a lot more. Windows, unless you started off with like vinyl windows, eventually those things are going to have to be replaced, around $8,000. Flooring, good grief, I could not imagine that flooring had gone up this month. $7,000 for flooring in this house.
Wow.
Unreal. Hot water heater. You know, got it all cranked up, everything going, and noticed, oh, there's a leak in a hot water heater. Well, there goes another $1,800. Appliances. You know, dishwasher, about $500. An oven can be anywhere from $800 to $2,000. Of course, you can spend a fortune on any of these things. Refrigerators. Oh, my goodness. $1,200 just for kind of basic stuff. I mean, $2,000 if you're going to get one that's fancy. All of these things add up. These are massive amounts, but we go back to that rule of thumb we talked about, and that is you need to be putting up about 1% of what your house is worth every year into your maintenance account. If your house is worth $250,000, you want to be putting up $2,500 a year. That's about $200 a month. Make yourself a little savings account. Call it your house maintenance account and make a deposit into it every month. Now, here's what you're going to have to be careful about. You don't want to raid your maintenance account for items that are just discretionary. You want to repaint the house because you don't like the color purple that you painted it, you know, that's out of style now. Well, I don't suggest using your maintenance budget for that. That's discretionary, so pay for that out of pocket. Don't put it on your credit cards. Pay for it out of pocket. Furniture. Your maintenance account is not for buying furniture. It's not to replace your mattress with. Okay, that you fund somewhere else. New light fixtures. You know, these are things, all these things run in fads. I noticed that I just am getting emails now that we're returning to gold things. Okay. Haven't seen gold since like the 80s, you know. The excess, the years of the 80s were excess of everything. Everything was gold, you know. So I've just seen the first bath fixtures that are gold. You know, we went to chrome, and then we went to like copper, but now we're back to gold.
Everything comes back around.
Get that maintenance account set up. And remember, folks, your house can be one of the best investments you ever make. Call us. We'll help you tailor a specific financial plan with your house so you can pass this on to your children so that you have something when you retire. Call us, 864-235-9596. This has been The Mortgage Moment with Carrie Deese and Mark Wells.